From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, it was another bad week for the tea, just in time for our first winter storm.
When I first arrived, it said the next train would be here in 5 minutes, and the train after that would be arriving in 20 minutes. And at this point, the signs are showing that the Forest Hills train is just stopped.
Plus, the House of Representatives is moving forward with drafting articles of impeachment. We'll cover it all and take your calls in our Week in Review. Also today, in the great Christmas songs, those treetops glisten.
Now, let me make treetops not glisten.
No, I want them to glisten.
Well, the treetops glisten. There's no glistening, but listen to one note. Treetops. That one note.
That's all next on WBUR's Radio Boston. This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and it's Friday, which means it's time for our Week in Review, and it was a bad week for riding the T. First, there was the commuter rail coach that detached from its train Monday morning, causing widespread delays on all lines going in and out of South Station. Then, an MBTA bus slid into a home in Chelsea early Tuesday morning. And the Orange Line suffered significant delays Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday because of a power issue and several mechanical failures. All of this, of course, during and in the aftermath of our first winter storm. WBUR reporter Shannon Dooling was out on the Orange Line Tuesday, stuck at Community College waiting for a southbound train.
We just got an update saying that southbound service is delayed because of a power problem on the line. And at this point, the signs are showing that the Forest Hills train is just stopped.
We also learned that 12 new Orange Line cars had been removed from service last month because they were making a, quote, uncommon noise. MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak addressed that issue on Wednesday.
I know this is a great inconvenience for our customers. I know people love the new cars. We really look forward to putting them back into service, but we want to make sure that we fix this problem now.
What is going on with the T? Here to discuss this with us is Renee Loth, a columnist for the Boston Globe and a contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Renee.
Thank you.
Also, Charlie Chippio, senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute, head of Chippio Strategies. Welcome back to Radio Boston, Charlie.
Good to be here. Thank you.
And you, welcome back to Radio Boston. Join this conversation. We want to hear from you. Did you have transportation troubles this week? Get stuck by the T? What other frustrations do you have with the T, driving, transportation in Greater Boston? And do you have any potential solutions? Call us 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. All right, Charlie, Renee, ironically, the T actually held a system-wide drill today so workers could practice procedures necessary to keep the trains running during a major snowstorm. But we're barely into winter and we're having some troubles. If this is service in December, are you worried, Renee, about February, March?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's actually still by the calendar fall. Think about it. And I love that story about the new Orange Line trains being pulled off service because of the uncommon noise. I mean, I think the uncommon noise is the primal scream of the commuters on the, not just the Orange Line, but, you know, on all of the T lines. And even, you know, those all by themselves in their cars stuck in traffic, giving vent to the primal scream. Transportation in this region is just a catalog of horrors. It doesn't even matter whether it's public transit, you know, or private sitting in your car. And, my concern, in addition to the immediacy of, you know, trying to get where we need to go, is that the growth and economic boom that we're, you know, experiencing and loving here is really in danger of us choking on our own growth unless we figure out, you know, how to get people where they need to go.
So, Charlie, as we were getting ready for the storm on Monday, we had here on the show State Highway Administrator Jonathan Gulliver. Mm-hmm. Tuesday, some of those Orange Line trains suffered delays during the storm. Right. Gulliver had said, hey, Tuesday, please take public transit instead of driving mm-hmm. during the storm. How do you ask people to do that if people don't trust the T is going to get them where they need to go?
No, that's right. You really can't. I'm not sure, frankly, that a lot of these problems were weather-related. I just think it's the ongoing issues at the T. It's, look, it is a very, very difficult problem. It is one where really, if you want to look at it from the larger sense, you know, I mean, people like me, and you know, I think your listeners know I am not a genius. We're writing
our
about
listeners
this for,
love you, Charlie.
Yeah, right. We're writing about this for 15 years before 2015 happened. It was so clear that it was coming, and nobody did anything. So by the time 2015 came,
Snowmageddon.
The tea was in such a horrible condition that I think, you know, in my view, a lot of the right things have been done since 2015, but we're still years away from really being able to see improvement. It's a very, very difficult situation.
So here's actually MBTA General Manager Steve Poftak. You say a lot of the right things are being done, and he does explain that on the 12 new Orange Line cars that got pulled, the focus was on safety.
Mm-hmm. I've repeatedly emphasized to our vehicle engineering team that safety and a durable long life for these cars is top priority. So by catching this issue now, we're able to fix it and for the remaining cars not have this issue to occur.
So, Renee, as Charlie says, the investments come. Do we now need to be patient as these kinks are worked out?
Well, you know, yes, there are bugs in the system. What the general manager was talking about was an uneven wearing of some rubber gasket or something that was on the line that he talked about. We also have to worry not only about safety, but about the longevity of this big investment that the state has made in these new cars, and they don't want them wearing out before their time. You know, I just think that the situations between the public transit and people driving are actually interlocked, you know, or interlinked. And it's important to think about the broader picture and things we can be doing about traffic congestion in general. For the life of me, I do not understand why Governor Baker continues to stubbornly resist even a pilot project in congestion pricing.
Couldn't agree more on that.
You know, he says that, oh, it's unfair to drivers who don't have any other choice. So the other choice is to make public transit, viable as an option.
It does feel like we've got a rock and a hard place.
So there's a lot of interlocks there, and you have to tease them apart in order to be able to get anywhere.
1-800 Yeah. Oh, Charlie.
No,
go ahead,
so the other thing, I'm the least mechanically inclined person you'd ever meet. But the other thing I don't understand is why is it that there's a 5-year lag time to order these trains and get? It seems to me that it should not be beyond the ability of modern engineering to have more of a off-the-shelf, you know, cars that you can order for these systems.
Yeah, so we've ordered 152 new Orange Line cars. The goal is for them to all be in service, but not till 2022.
Right.
And then 404 cars overall, but not until 2023 for that. All right, let's take a couple of calls. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Steve from Hyde Park, pull up a chair. What's on your mind?
Good afternoon.
Hi.
I've been listening to this on your station, and I've been watching the news regarding these proposals for new taxes and trying to solve the transportation issue. We have a major issue in Boston going on here. Aside from the gentrification, we have these new plywood palaces going up all over town to house more residents. Has anybody given thought to how we're going to transport them around once they move into town?
Okay, so Steve is raising an interesting point, Charlie, which is we got a lot of new housing construction. And Renee, right, we have new housing construction supposedly invites new people to move into those houses.
Where the price tags don't so much invite new people to move into those houses.
Too.
But there is this idea of transit-oriented development, which is that the housing is going to be, you know, within, a 10-minute walk from a T station. But, you know, we didn't need a Boston Globe Spotlight team investigative report to tell us that traffic is bad. But when you looked at that report that the Globe ran
last month,
it had some amazing numbers in it. And the caller's point, there's something like 300,000 additional cars and trucks in the greater Boston region than there were just 5 years ago. These are people moving in, new jobs, you know, new housing. People are coming into the city. It's great that it's growing, But you know, where are these people going to go?
Right.
Let's take – oh, go ahead.
No, and also I just say, you know, to make this even more complicated, of course, you have the climate change issue. Mm-hmm. And so we need to – you know, in the longer term, I think clearly if we want more people to take the public transportation, fewer people to drive, then we need to obviously create the capacity to actually get them around in a way that works for them. And we're also going to need to stop doing the thing where we increase the transit fares, but we never increase tolls and that kind of thing. You know, we're going to mm-hmm. have to incentivize what we want.
Okay, because we're headed into a weekend and I also like to be happy, we do have one caller, McRae from Lowell, who has something positive to say. So, McRae, make me a little happier. Go ahead.
Yeah, sure. So I got a family. I got two boys and a wife, and we were down in D.C. for Thanksgiving. And so we drove back up. I live in Lowell. We drove back up to Lowell on Sunday during the big storm. And, you know, we're driving through New York, and Connecticut was just a mess, freezing rain and sleet, and everybody, trucks are sliding off the road. So I get to Massachusetts, and I'm going behind, you know, four plows at once. There's salt in the road. The road's clear. I'm just like, it's much nicer. So I just want to say I really appreciate the DOT for taking good care of our roads during the storms. That's it.
McRae, you did your job. That is a happier
McRae's
that is
all
a
right.
happier now. Yeah. So there is a, you know, some props to the Department of Transportation. We are headed into snow season, and McRae's saying, hey, by the way, so they're New York and Connecticut. He just drove through, and there's a piece of this we're getting right. How are we getting those pieces right?
Well, I think part of it is that you know, we're comparing it to. I grew up in Connecticut, which is in basically.
I grew up in New York.
Well,
so
it was basically been on the verge of bankruptcy for you know. So I think we are doing better than Connecticut, but that doesn't mean we're doing good enough.
So Renee, one last question on mm-hmm. this, and then we'll go to a break. How do we hold people accountable? Who do we hold accountable, mm-hmm. and for what mm-hmm. do we hold people accountable? Right now.
Yeah. Well, you know, we need to change people's behaviors and we need to change people's attitudes about transportation. How do they get where they need to go? It's kind of a chicken egg thing because it is difficult to try to encourage or incentivize people to use public transit instead of driving when public transit is not up to snuff. There are employers, there are politicians. You know, I'm going back to this Spotlight Team report that was so compelling. Who just themselves are not modeling, you know, good behaviors in terms of using public transit. People are driving in privately. People are driving solo. I mean, I can't remember the number off the top of my head now, but there's some tens of thousands of people who drive in solo every morning, and that's got to change.
All right, Charlie, last word before a break.
Well, I think certainly in terms of the T, the things that have to happen are fundamental, and I don't see – I'm going to be the opposite of McRae. I think the changes that have to happen are huge, and I don't see the political will to do the things that are really need to happen because they're very difficult.
Okay, Renee and Charlie, stick around. We're going to take a quick break. Please, you stick around too. Coming back, we'll talk about the latest in the impeachment inquiry. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's our Week in Review, and still with us in Studio 3 is Renee Loth, columnist for the Boston Globe and a contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti. Welcome back, Renee.
Thank you.
Also still with us is Charlie Chippio, senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute and head of Chippio Strategies. Charlie, thanks.
Sure.
All right, as I said before the break, we are going to go to impeachment in a minute, so get your calls ready, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. But we just want to spend a couple of minutes first on another story that it has been making some local waves, and that's about Bristol County Sheriff Thomas Hodgson, who has the ACLU of Massachusetts has revealed emails and reviewed them, they and the Globe, that show that Hodgson has stayed in very close touch with the Trump administration and in pretty constant contact with controversial White House senior advisor Stephen Miller. He praises Miller in the emails, praises his media appearances, keeps him abreast of developments around immigration in Massachusetts, even once sort of tattled on his own church after he found flyers in the back that seemed to be designed to help immigrants know their rights when dealing with law enforcement. So here's Carol Rose, executive director of the ACLU of Massachusetts, talking about why the correspondence is troubling.
The sheriff seems to be spending an extraordinary amount of time during work hours corresponding with Trump administration officials rather than doing what the people have elected him to do, which is namely to keep our communities safe and free.
Charlie, what was your reaction when you first heard about these emails?
Well, my reaction was, one, that this is a guy who desperately wants to get a job in Washington. And, you know, the other thing was just that it was kind of pathetic. It was this classic thing where he's just texting Miller all the time and occasionally getting these one or two word responses. You know, it's like, I mean, and that doesn't even get into the substance of it all. But it was just it's the whole thing is distasteful. Yeah.
So, Renee, let me just say, I just want to say quickly, we did reach out to Sheriff Hodgson's office for comment today. We were not able to hear back from the sheriff before the start of the show. So I just want to note that. Renee, go ahead.
Good point. I mean, the column by Yvonne Abraham was really, pathetic on one hand and really concerning on the other. I mean,
why is it concerning?
Well, so Tom Hodgson is sort of our own personal version of Joe Arpaio, you know, the Arizona sheriff, who's very hard line on immigration and criminal justice issues, but he's very flamboyant. He loves the limelight. He loves getting underneath the skin of liberals. And it's tempting in a way to just sort of laugh off his antics, except that, you know, people were laughing about Donald Trump, too, initially, and now he's, like, busily ripping up the Constitution, you know, which I think we're going to get to in a minute.
But let me push back for a minute. What's wrong with a sheriff digging the White House?
No, there's nothing wrong with that. And indeed, the voters, it's worth pointing out that the voters of Bristol County have elected the sheriff, I think, four times, or maybe he's in his fourth
term. I think
term.
He's the longest serving sheriff right now.
So, you know, he must be doing something right, as the old joke goes. But, you know, you have to think about, first of all, many of his policies actually hurt real people. You know, when he has inmates out on work release, they have to be wearing shackles like a chain gang. You know, he was going to charge rent to the inmates. He's tried to make it as miserable and difficult as possible. People have committed suicide in his jails.
He's actually faced lawsuits.
It's a higher rate than in other jails. So, you know, it's not trivial stuff. And so that's the first thing on policy. And in terms of the politics of trying to, you know, be obsequiously pandering to the White House, that's fine, except that Stephen Miller is a really problematic person.
Yeah.
Problematic is not even the right word. I mean, he is a...
It's very gentle.
Yeah. Here's a guy who has been promoting white supremacist views before he became part of the White House, yes, and white supremacist literature. You know, he has notions that immigrants are all responsible for the crime wave. He promotes these ideas that are just attitudes at the highest levels of government now in his position, in Steve Miller's position, that should not be normalized, and they should not be, embraced, really, by an elected official in Massachusetts, my view.
So, Charlie, the other dimension of this that we're hearing in response to these emails is that this is work time paid by the taxpayers, and it's inappropriate use of work time. Do you buy that argument?
Well, I think we would need more. We would need more investigation into that. I think what I'm more concerned by is the fact, you know, I not long ago did a study on this criminal justice reform stuff for governing. Look, I mean, the approach that Hodgson is taking that has been used in the past across the board, no matter what your ideology thing is, what your ideology is, the data is so clear that it has not worked and that it has not benefited anybody. And that as much as you might feel good about punishing somebody who you think deserves it, the fact of the matter is that there are other approaches that cost everybody a lot less, that cause everybody a lot less pain, and that's more important than the momentary satisfaction of punishing the bad guy.
So it's a wrong-headed approach.
It's a wrong-headed approach.
All right. There's more that we could do there, but I do want to make sure we get to just a minute of impeachment, because this week House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced that the House of Representatives would move forward with drafting policy articles of impeachment. There's a lot going on. There was testimony this week by specialists in the Constitution and in impeachment. So let me just start quickly by asking you, did anything change in America this week with the latest round of hearings? Charlie.
I think they didn't. I shouldn't say that. They didn't politically. Over time, we'll see what will happen. I guess the one thing that I am wondering about this, and I understand that the answer is politics, is that, you know, speaking as someone who has 6 years of bad law school grades to get through a three-year program, I don't really – why, since they're not benefiting anyway, why the Democrats wouldn't let this – all this subpoena stuff and obstruction of justice stuff make their way through the courts, force Trump to defy a court ruling, and then it seems like this becomes a slam dunk.
Okay, so Doug Collins actually made a similar argument. He mm-hmm. is the representative from Georgia. And we brought that argument to Nancy Gertner, our legal analyst and a former federal judge, here on Radio Boston yesterday. Her answer was that you can't not show up after being subpoenaed. And so the failure to do so is too brazen to merit judicial intervention.
Hmm. To some degree, saying that they had to go to the courts to, for the purposes of articulating something which is absolutely clear. Doesn't make any sense. So it's clear that this is a pretext. Pushing the Democrats to go to the courts only means you get the predictable decision, which I said is absolutely clear, and they are just going to appeal it.
Well, and I have no doubt that it's a pretext. I think that's absolutely true. But I think the reality is that impeachment is a political act, and that you need to have, you know, more than just 50% support to have it work.
What's it going to take, Renee?
Well, you know, another argument that you hear a lot about, and I think that has some merit, is that why don't we wait for the election? You know, like, why don't we let democracy decide this instead of, you know, the Congress? But I think that our founders, when they put impeachment into the Constitution specifically, were anticipating a situation where a president was going to try to corrupt our elections. And I'm sorry to say that I don't have a whole lot of trust and faith in the 2020 election alone. And I think the Congress absolutely has done the right thing to act.
Yeah, I don't think you could just let it sit and let this go unaddressed.
All right. So I think that's a good note to end on. That was Charlie Chippio, senior fellow at the Pioneer Institute, head of Chippio Strategies. Thanks for being part of Week in Review.
Thank you.
Also, Renee Loth, a columnist for the Boston Globe and a contributor to WBUR's Cognoscenti. Thanks for being with us.
Always good. Thank you.
Hey, thank you for being with us, and stay with us. There's more ahead. Coming up, we're going to talk about how Jewish immigrants wrote the current soundtrack to Christmas. I'm Tiziana Dearing. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Dearing. If you've heard composer Rob Capello before, you know he has a true gift for helping us all appreciate what makes the music that we love so great. And this weekend, he's going to turn that talent to Christmas music, and actually a specific subset of Christmas music. On Sunday, Rob will be performing at the New England Conservatory's Jordan Hall at 3 p.m. It's presented by the Celebrity Series of Boston, and you can find out more info about it on our website, radioboston.org. But don't run to your computer or smartphone to snag tickets right now, because right now, that's Rob playing, and he joins us here in Studio 3. Rob, welcome back to Radio Boston.
It's so great to be here. Thanks for having me.
I actually kind of just want to sit and listen to you play for the next few minutes.
I've been waiting for somebody to say that for me all my life.
All right, we don't have a ton of time, because if we did, you'd just keep playing. But let's start with your show this weekend. It's called What Makes It Great? Dreaming of a Jewish Christmas. So tell us about that.
Well, you know, one of the most amazing things I discovered was almost all of our most famous Christmas songs, the one that we've known for our all lives, were actually written by Jewish composers. I mean, that's a sort of a strange fact, that these songs that have become kind of the soundtrack of the world's most widely celebrated Christian holiday were all written by Jewish composers.
So why do you think that is, and why do most people not know that?
You know, I think one of the things that's interesting is it's really a story about pogrom, prejudice, poverty, immigration, assimilation, and the powerful creative imaginations of an extraordinary group of songwriters who are trying to find their way into an American culture. You know, first of all, lots of roads into American culture were blocked for these Jews, but they wanted to become part of that American world. And so what they did was they looked around, they listened around, and they created the soundtrack of secular Christmas. You know, before that, really before 1941 and 1942, when we got White Christmas, which was kind of the foundational sort of center of all of these secular Christmas songs, Christmas songs were religious. The holiday was really about Christ, and it was a religious holiday, but it was really these Jewish composers who invented secular Christmas. But it wasn't only them. You know, interestingly enough, the term Judeo-Christian tradition was actually invented by the military, who wanted to forge interreligious bonding among soldiers. It became patriotic to celebrate Christmas. In fact, rabbis advocated Jews celebrating Christmas, and Franklin Roosevelt declared one day a year, only one day, Christmas Day, as the day that the plants and factories would close in 1942. So it was all part of becoming American, assimilating, becoming part of that American dream, and it was Jewish composers who invented the soundtrack Christmas.
It's an incredible piece of history, and one I'm guessing, you know, most people don't know about.
Right.
So let's pair that now. I've heard interviews with you in the past. You do this incredible job of breaking down these songs.
Uh-huh.
I'm dying to hear you do one of them. I think one of the ones you're going to do on Sunday that you've prepared for us today is I'm Dreaming of a White Christmas.
Well, it is the foundational cornerstone. You know, before this piece, everybody thought, why write Christmas songs? It would only be one day a year seasonal songs. There'd be no money in it whatsoever. But this became...
That is kind of a good point, now that you mention it.
Publishers said, forget it. No one's interested. But this became the top-selling piece of music ever written. And in fact, to come full circle, it's even been recorded in Yiddish.
Oh, my gosh.
So, but what makes the actual song so great? Okay, so here's the opening, the famous opening. Dreaming of a White Christmas. You know, one of the things I try to get across in all these programs, whether it's on radio or live, is that the difference between good and great is both enormous and infinitesimal. It's hundreds of small, tiny choices made by a composer, note by note, rhythm by rhythm, and word by word, measure by measure. So I'm going to just remove some of the great details of these opening four bars. It could have sounded like this. This is almost White Christmas. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. Now, every single note is spectacular. Instead of this boring opening chord, he adds one note which gives you all the warmth of the season. Ordinary Berlin. Then instead of this, every note is special. Dreaming. That's like sort of robbing your hand on a foggy window. Just that one difference between dreaming of a and dreaming.
It's incredible. It's like the difference between a military march and my dreams.
Absolutely. The dream is literally in those tiny changes. Here's ordinary. White Christmas. Ordinary. White. Listen to this. Christmas. That is a spectacular Christmas. Just a few notes. Again, just continuing. He could have written this. Just like the ones I know. But he reaches one note higher, and all the yearning of the season is in that one note. Just like the ones. So much yearning. You know, an interesting fact is, Berlin had one of his children die on Christmas Day in 1928. And for him, Christmas was always a painful day. He and his wife would always visit their child's grave on Christmas Day. And that yearning that you feel there is all in that one note. But also think of this moment in time. It's Christmas of 1942, the first Christmas in which the GIs are away from home. And all that longing for what they're missing to come back to this idyllic, mythic American past, is in that one note.
So the skeptic in me is like, dude, you can't put all of that in one note. But you do.
It's all about one note. I mean, listen, treetops glisten. It's one of the only images of Christmas. The whole song only has two images of Christmas. Treetops glistening and children listening to sleigh bells. Now, let me make treetops not glisten.
No, I want them to glisten.
Well, the treetops glisten. There's no glistening, but listen to one note. Treetops. That one note. Suddenly they're glistening. Now, children listening to sleigh bells could have been ordinary like this. Children listen. But listen to this descending line in the piano and the one minor chord on listen. Children, listen to this. I mean, all the pain, the yearning in that one note, just... I mean, that's what makes the song magic. Then, to hear the sleigh bells in the snow, the sleigh bells are literally in the piano part at the end. To hear sleigh bells while the voice is holding, the piano's going, the bells go ring-dong-ding-dong. I mean, that's what makes this song great. And then the ending is spectacular. That's the basic idea of the whole song. We start to repeat the exact same melody for the second half. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas, all the same with every Christmas card I write. But then instead of your tops glisten and then a leap down, now it goes, may your days be merry. And I mean, there is nothing better on earth than that. But here's again the double meaning of Christmas. Right on bright. He holds that note for 6 beats, longest note of the song. You get this beautiful bright, but then listen to this. It's that dark minor. We're bright, but then we remember back to that child in 1928.
Oh, no, I did. Oh, brought me back to the lost child.
And then the ending is spectacular. Though no one except our singers has ever sung the rhythms that Berlin wrote, up to this point in the song, every note has either been a single beat note or a held note. Long note, single, 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 long, single, single. The only dotted rhythm in the whole song is right on the word Christmases to make it jaunty and bright. And may all your, the one dotted note, Christmases, that one rhythm. And the last note is special in a way you would never guess. Follow this. In all tonal music, the home chord has 3 notes. No matter what key you're in, the home chord has 3 notes. There's what we call the root, the name of it, a C chord, a C, and then 2 other notes. The most conclusive version of that is when the melody plays the root note. These versions are less final. They're like commas or semicolons. This is a period.
Yeah.
This is a comma. This is a semicolon. There are 6 of those home chords in the piece. Mm-hmm. Every other one has either this or this in the melody. I'm dreaming of a white Christmas. This or this.
Continuing to the next
Always
thing.
This. We never resolve. Only on the very last note of the song, on Christmases, do we get the home note. And not only does the song resolve, but in a way, metaphorically, all those GIs overseas get to return home, just like the song, to our home note, save for the very last note.
You know, I will often say after interviewing someone, I'll never see such and such the same way again. Usually there's a loss to that. But in this case, I'll never hear that song in the same way again, and I'm so glad.
Well, you know, that's really what the whole program is about. I'm taking all of these songs and giving all the backstory to them as well as the musical insight so that hopefully at the end of the program you will neither hear nor think about these songs in the same way. And believe me, the backstories are extraordinary. Just to come and hear the backstory to Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer would be worth the entire price of admission.
I've heard that you're not going to tell
us that. I am not going to tell
you. Any hints at all?
I will not. I will just tell you that the song is not what you think it's about. It's not about its bouncy melody. But I will tell you it's actually a parable about an outsider young Jewish boy.
Interesting.
And that's the key.
Yeah, now I got to come hear it.
Yeah.
All right, we've got about a minute left. So in that time, this is a big question, but in your mind, what makes a great Christmas song?
Well, I think one of the things that's really important is it's different over time. You know, there's a wonderful quote from Irving Berlin, and he says, songs make history, and history makes songs. Mm. In other words, if you want to understand American history, listen to its popular song. If you want to understand popular songs, listen to its history. So oftentimes, it's actually a moment in time that makes a great Christmas song. As I said, before White Christmas, no one wrote seasonal Christmas songs. It just wasn't going to be interesting enough. But this song, it first appeared on a Bing Crosby radio program on Christmas Eve 1941. No one paid any attention. It was 2.5 weeks after Pearl Harbor. But then, on that Christmas of 1942, when it was the first Christmas with the GIs away from home, suddenly this became the kind of idyllic world that they were missing. It became everything they were fighting for, a kind of why we fight anthem. It was what they were longing for. And suddenly it became a great Christmas song, not only because of the notes that I showed you, but because what it evoked at that particular moment in time. You know, when you hear other songs, sometimes we'll hear another song that happens at the end of the war, 1945, and then that's the song that touches the hearts and became the love ballad of the GIs returning home. So at different moments in time, different songs intersect with history, and it's a combination of the magical notes, note by note, rhythm by rhythm that I've shown you, and that moment in time and what the country needs, because these composers were inventing secular Christmas. Now they're the songs we hear everywhere, but remember, they were invented by Jewish immigrants trying to become part of the American dream, inventing America's voice.
On that note, are you willing to play us out?
I'd be happy to do it.
Let's do it.
That's composer Rob Capello. He'll be performing at New England Conservatory's Jordan Hall, 3 p.m. Sunday. The concert's presented by the Celebrity Series of Boston, and you can find more information at our website, radioboston.org. And Rob has a book. It's called Listening for America, Inside the Great American Songbook from Gershwin to Sondheim. Rob Capello, thanks so much for coming in today.
A pleasure to be here.
That's our show for today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Tiziana Deering. Join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.